about the development of complexity in physical systems. Here is one example of such development of complexity. This is a computer simulation of an explosion on the surface of a star. As you can see, it gets messy and complex. And I'm going to be talking about some of the hydrodynamic processes that look a little bit like this later on. You will see in this picture small structures which are called plumes. They look like they have a mushroom cap on them and a straw. We'll come back to those plumes and those structures later on. Now I just continue with the regular stuff. The title is Making a Splash, Breaking a Neck, the Making of Complexity in Physical Systems. And this first view graph shows a splash produced by a drop of milk which lands in a glass of milk. The fundamental laws of physics are very simple. Here is something you can write on a sweatshirt or on the back of a t-shirt, the front of a t-shirt. The world of us is very complex. Living things are very, very complex indeed. This complexity has led some thinkers to suggest that living things are not the outcome of physical law, but instead the creation of a design. In this talk, I will talk about how complexity is produced in physical systems. Here's another example of something that's complex. This is a magnetic storm on the surface of the sun. This time it's real. The last one was a simulation. In part, I'm going to be talking about political things. In part, it was my responsibility as president of the American Physical Society to worry and wonder a little bit about some of the things I'm going to talk about on the political side. Intelligent design is a subject of a political and intellectual discussion. Its proponents argue that biological systems are too complex to have been the product of any natural evolution, Darwinian or otherwise, but instead must have been a result of a fashioning by some super intelligent creator or creator with a capital C. I'm going to be talking about three proponents of this point of view. First, the Reverend William Paley, sort of a 19th and 18th century figure, who argued that if you picked up a watch on the beach and looked at the watch, you could tell without further discussion that this watch was the result of some intelligent creator, that the fashioning was too complex, the interrelation between the parts too intricate, that the design was manifest in all of the things you saw in the watch. He then went on to argue that if you look at the world, and especially at living things, that those living things were equally obviously the result of a creator, a result of some intelligent creation process. This point of view has been recreated, resurrected in our time by various thinkers. I'm going to be talking today mostly about two of them. Michael Behe, a biochemist who looks at the behavior of cells, and Bill Dembski, a philosopher and mathematician who has theorems which describe search processes. Now, I should tell you about the politics. The Discovery Institute is a think tank, not entirely different from this think tank in some of its aspects, which supports intelligent design research and the spread of intelligent design ideas as part of a wedge strategy which seeks nothing less than the overthrow of materialism and its cultural legacies. You'll notice the quotation marks on this view. The quotation marks indicate that I quoted this from one of their documents. And so you can rely that it is, their point of view being reported with fair accuracy. The Discovery Institute has reopened the case for a broadly theistic understanding of nature. They say, we will move towards direct confrontation with the advocates of materialist science through challenge conferences in significant academic settings. We will also pursue, well, up to this point, there's nothing particularly controversial in what they're doing. But right now, we get to something somewhat controversial. They say, we will also pursue the integration of design theory into public school curriculum. What should we, as intelligent citizens and academics, do about it? As academics, we should consider the validity of the intelligent design arguments with open and critical minds. That's our job as academics. As intelligent citizens, we should think about curricular issues for the schools. This talk is mostly about science, but it does return to curricular issues at the end. I start with the structure of physics, a subject which I suspect all of you have thought about a lot. The laws of physics are simple. A few lines often expressed as partial differential equations, which express rates of change in physical quantities in space and time. The ideas of physics are simple. The ideas here given in red is that the world is lawful, that the same basic laws hold everywhere and always, that new domains of nature may require new laws, but all the different laws are consistent with one another. Here I have a choice to make. I can either go on, and you all will say ho-hum because you've heard things like this before, or I can do something provocative. I choose to do something provocative. I point out that the material in red is basically religious. It's uncheckable. It is not, there's no empirical way of seeing it. It is something that we, many of us, believe, but it is a religious set of beliefs that we, many of us, hold to. In any case, we'll come back to that, but let's talk about the world. Everything is simple, neat, and expressible in terms of everyday mathematics, usually partial differential equations. Everything is simple and neat except for the world. Here's a picture of the world as you might get it from a bad physics course. And nobody here has ever taken a bad physics course. Nobody here has ever taught a bad physics course. Nonetheless, I can tell you what a bad physics course does. A bad physics course presents the world as the repetition of the same things over and over and over again, just repeating the same laws again and again and again. That's not the way the world looks. The world looks different. The world is much more complex than that. Here's a picture of something relatively simple. There is a cylinder here, and there is a flow of fluid past this cylinder. The fluid is made manifest by these smoke lines that move with the fluid. As you can see from the smoke lines, what happens is that the flow around the cylinder produces swirls, a swirl in one direction, and the opposite from that one. And these swirls appear alternately on one side or the other. Each swirl is somewhat different from the last. Each swirl has its own size and its own placement. Repetition of similar things again and again is a hallmark of a simple kind of complexity. Here's another example of such a complexity. This is the surface of a cake of soap magnified some 200 times. As you can see, there are round objects on this surface. Those round objects can slide past one another, and you can almost feel how the soap is slippery because of those round objects. These round objects appear again and again, each with its own placement, each with its own size, with some variations. Here's yet another example. Here is a water emptying out into a bay, carrying mud. The mud is dropped in patterns of repetitive stuff, which appears complex, but not too complex. You can find many more complex things in the world. Here is a storm on the surface of the planet Jupiter. Colors provided by the US government, by NASA, the storm itself is provided by Jupiter. You can see the swirl here, and another swirl up there, and other things happen. There is a motion more up and back in the blue part over there. And there are various different things going on, but not too many of them. And this storm has a complexity more than the things I presented to you before, but less than complexity I'm about to show you. This is another picture magnified some 200 times. This is a picture, as it says, of a mosquito. Mosquito is composed of many working parts, each working part somewhat different from the last. All the working parts work together to an apparent purpose. You can see the bumps here and the hair there and whatever that is there and the eyes and the antenna. Each part is intended for a purpose. That apparent purpose is maybe to bite us or to reproduce itself or whatever else you might think of as the purpose of a mosquito. Here's some of the dynamics of complexity. This again is a picture of a drop falling into a glass of milk. This picture was the same set that I showed you before. It's taken by Edgerton. Edgerton is the inventor of strobe photography. Here's the drop falling, hitting the glass of milk. Here it produces a crater. The crater comes up, and you can see bumps coming up on the surface. Those bumps come up as a stalk and a round piece, and the round piece starts to come off as drops. Different drops come off at different times because of at the beginning, there were small swirls of air going across the surface of the milk. Those swirls perturb the flow. Because the results are sensitively dependent upon the initial conditions, different drops come off at different times. Until in this final picture, we see a whole bunch of drops, including one more that came up from the center and went shooting way up in the air. A whole complex outcome produced from nothing much, just a glass and a drop. Okay, words. What words are writing? I have told you about one type of complexity. That means we have structure with variations. It was exemplified by the soap. Type 2 complexity, exemplified by the mosquito, means that we have structures piled upon structures to achieve an apparent purpose. Chaos means that there are many different variations, and it's hard to predict which one will come out in a given place and time. A complex world is interesting. In a chaotic world, we don't know what's coming next. Our world is both complex and chaotic. Now on to Michael Behe. Behe argues that biological objects, biological cells in particular, are too complex to have arisen from any natural process. They're composed of many working parts, and each part is necessary for the organism to function. How could so many parts have evolved independently? Since he cannot imagine any natural process which might have produced this outcome, Behe argues that such a complex outcome must be the result of the creator, or creator with a capital C. Behe's argument is mostly theoretical. We as theoretical physicists should applaud theoretical arguments, but it does depend on the strength of his imagination. Let's be more real. Let's look and see how complexity actually rises in our world. Let's look at a particular fluid flow. Here I depict, in the upper right-hand corner, a pot, maybe like the pot that you boiled water in the morning to produce a boiled egg. This pot is heated from below and cooled from above. And inside, there's fluid, and that fluid carries heat from below to above. Like most fluids, the heated fluid is less dense
than the colder fluid, and therefore gravity tries to push it upward. When the heating rate becomes larger, the heated fluid starts to move upward and a regular pattern of motion is produced. Hot fluid going up, cold fluid coming down, some swirls in the corners. With increased heating rate beyond this, the motion becomes more chaotic. Different portions of the thing wiggle independently of each other, and you get a pattern of motion which is rather complex to look at. And with further heating, you get something that looks like this. This is a picture taken from a laboratory in which someone looked through a window into the pot and showed the pattern of motion in the pot in which fluid is going up here and coming down here and going around like this. But there are elements, such as these mushroom-shaped objects, which I'll come to in a moment, which move in a rather chaotic fashion. These mushroom-shaped objects are called plumes, and they produce the chaos in this system. Now, how do we study such a thing? One way of studying such a thing is to look at the thermometers in it. Here's a thermometer. There's a thermometer right there. There's a thermometer. Look at the thermometers in it and measure the temperature in these thermometers. Here is the temperature as a function of time. In a very Cuban scale units, time is in seconds, and temperature is in degrees or millidegrees. The center thermometer shows an up and down chaotic pattern, so does the bottom thermometer. You can look at these patterns all month, and more or less I have, and you don't make much sense out of them. You could also look at the partial differential equations, which describe the thing. This u of rt is the velocity at the space-time point rt. This t of rt is the temperature at the space-time point rt. I suspect that there's nobody in the audience that I have to tell that this is the time derivative saying how these things change in time, and this is the gradient saying how they change in space. These partial differential equations tell you how the velocity and the temperature have interconnected changes in time and space. If you leave the temperature out, these equations are called the Navier-Stokes equations and are the basic equations of fluid flow. From studying many simple situations, we learn that these Navier-Stokes equations describe and predict all fluid flows. But in interesting, complex situations, mostly you can't learn much directly from the equations. I also spent months of my life staring at these equations and not learning much from them. What you learn more from is looking at the phenomenology of this situation. The phenomenology is in part composed of plumes, mushroom-shaped objects that I already told you about. I'm going to tell you how a plume works, and then show you plumes in action in many situations. Imagine that I'm a piece of hot fluid. In fact, I am a piece of hot fluid, but the next thing I'm going to say is not true. Imagine that I am less dense than the fluid around me. If I were less dense than the fluid around me, gravitational forces would be pushing me upward and pulling the fluid around me downward, and there would be a tendency for me to move upward. As I moved upward, I would push on the fluid above me, and the fluid above would push back. The net result is an outward motion, and that outward motion looks like this, and then I'm pushing out with the hot fluid, and the fluid is pushing back, and it curls under like that, producing hot fluid going up and then curling over in a mushroom pattern. Heated fluids are everywhere you look. I'm going to show you a bunch of slides of heated fluids. In this case, what you have is a candle heating air. This is one more picture by Edgerton. Edgerton, it was the inventor of of strobe photography, and he loved to show how wonderful it was. Here we shall look at the plumes. There's a plume. There's another plume up there. There are plumes all over this, shown up by Edgerton's beautiful picture. Like many scientists, Edgerton was a bit of a cowboy. There is no reason on Earth that this shockwave or this bullet should be in the picture, except that Edgerton wants to show you how great his invention might be. Okay, here's more. Here's another plume. A familiar, unfortunately, familiar kind of plume. A stalk and a cap. This is a computer simulation of the surface of the sun. That surface is here. The interior of the sun is in this direction. You can see cold plumes falling down. There's a cold plume. There's a cold plume. There's another one. There's another one. The cold plumes fall into the interior of the sun and start moving around in a somewhat chaotic fashion. There you can see some plumes. You can also see some plumes if you look into the box with the experiment that I've been telling you about. Here is the interior of such an experiment, or rather the bottom, photographed by a group from the state of Pennsylvania in the United States. This is a succession of photographs with time going upwards that way. And in the succession of photographs, you see something. You see the motion of plumes. Here's a plume which starts out here and moves in this direction. Here's another plume which starts out closer to the wall over here. It moves. It hits the wall. It comes up along the wall and moves out of our sight. There is a skinny layer called the boundary layer of hot fluid, and the plumes move out of that boundary layer. Here's another photograph. This is a photograph, again, of the whole box. And I'm going to show you some things in it, and then I'm going to tell you how the thing works. Down here, you've got the boundary layer that I just told you about a moment ago. Coming up here, you have lots of plumes. This case is more dense with plumes than the last picture I showed you. These plumes come over, hit this wall, and move up along the wall. Here, for example, is a plume moving up along the wall. There are cold plumes which come down along this wall. There is a swirling overall motion like this. And there is motion across here. And a few plumes come loose in the center. Here you can see the thermometer that I talked about before. This picture is the only product of my science in this talk. Everything else is somebody else's. In this picture, I draw a cartoon view of this box. Here are the plumes moving this way across the bottom of the box. Here's the boundary layer. Here is a jet of upward moving fluid produced by lots of plumes. Here are a few plumes that have come loose in the center. Here is a top boundary layer, a zone here of containing lots of plumes called the mixing zone, and so forth. This cartoon has dynamics, which is shown in this next picture, in which the experimentalists who were studying the system describe its dynamics. The dynamics starts out with a wave moving across the boundary layer at the bottom of the box. That wave is a thickening of that boundary layer. The wave produces a spray. That spray is pulled up by gravity. The spray is a spray of hot fluid. It's pulled up by gravity, and it forms up into a plume or a swirl. That plume moves across the bottom because there's an overall wind going in this direction. That moves across the bottom until it hits the wall. It moves up along the wall, and the plumes get together. And when they hit the top, they produce a splash. That splash produces a wave, which moves across the top boundary layer, moves across the side of the box, throwing down a spray of cold fluid. that a spray of cold fluid forms up into cold plumes. The cold plumes come down to here, and they produce a splash here. That splash starts out a wave, and so on and so forth. My story is that a whole complex machine has been produced by something which is no more complex to begin with than a pot of water heated from below and cooled from above. This machine has different working parts, each one serving to play a role in the apparent purpose of the machine. The apparent purpose of the machine is to move heat from the bottom to the top. Behe cannot imagine how a thing as complex as a living cell might have been produced. In physics, we often see things that are far beyond our initial imagination and expectation. I'll show you a couple of examples. Heinrich Jaeger is a colleague of mine at the University of Chicago, and he works on the properties of granular materials, sand. Imagine that we had a glass filled with sand, fluffed up a little bit, shaken up so it wasn't too densely packed, and you took a steel ball. You took a steel ball and held it up and then dropped it. It would land in there, and it would then, after a moment, produce a jet moving up. Because we saw the splash, we're not going to be terribly surprised by the jet. Here's a picture of that jet coming up. Now, since this is a physics lab, we can do lots of things. One thing you can do is evacuate the region around the glass so that you have a lower pressure of air around the thing. Here's what happens at a lower pressure. It is something of a surprise. The jet we now see comes in two pieces, and a fat piece and a skinny piece. And the fat piece is less high at the lower pressure. I dropped the ball from the same distance, or rather they did. They wouldn't let me touch anything in the lab. I dropped the ball from the same distance, but produced a different result. Here's a lower pressure yet, and you can see that the fat piece is getting real small, skinny piece remains about the same, and this last thing, which is at a lower pressure yet, the fat piece has disappeared completely. That's a surprise. We would never have imagined that something as tenuous as the air around us would have affected this splashing of the sand. Here's another example which produces another surprise. Imagine, these are all basically the same experiment, but done again with variations. Imagine we dropped a drop of fluid, in this case, alcohol, onto a flat, dry surface. This is what you get when you do that. It is not terribly surprising that it produces a splash, and that splash looks interesting, crown-shaped object, and interesting object. Now we do the same thing at a lower pressure. The surprise, as Sherlock Holmes said, is not in what happens, but in what doesn't happen. In his case, it was the dog that did not bark in the night. According to what we were expecting to see, there should have been a splash, but there was no splash at the lower pressure. Again, the tenuous air has affected things that are much more dense than the air in a way that we wouldn't have expected. Okay, how complex is the square dance? You might at begin, how complex is the fluid? You might in the beginning say, well, the fluid is pretty complex. It obeys the Navier-Stokes equation, and the Navier-Stokes equation is a partial differential equation, and that looks pretty complicated to me. I'm going to give you a picture in which the fluid is as simple as I can get it to be. The four basic ideas which will produce a fluid. The basic ideas are, first, the fluid contains many particles in motion. Second, conservation laws. The conservation of a number of particles and of momentum. This is a talk that I give to a general audience. And you may notice that I haven't included the conservation of energy here. It's sort of irrelevant for the process. It's not included. Third, that the momentum moves with the particles. Fourth is a technical requirement for translational invariance, rotational invariance, and locality, though they're put in a way that you'll see. The big idea is that if you do all these things, or a little bit more or a little less, right, you'll construct a model fluid just like the real fluid. Okay, so we start out and we work on a triangular lattice. And on the triangular lattice, we imagine particles. Here are the particles. There are six kinds of particles. Each kind of particle is labeled with an arrow. That arrow points in the direction of its momentum. So there are six different momenta depicted in this picture. And each particle is going to move in the direction of its arrow. OK. For the general audience, I would remind the audience of how adding momentum works. For the sake of going through the story, I do it here also. You take an arrow like that and an arrow like that, and those are two momenta. Add them by putting them head to tail, and the resultant is the thing that goes from the tail of one to the head of the other, as shown there. That's how you add momentum. We don't have to do anything as complicated as that. We just have to remember the two momenta in opposite directions add up to zero, and three momenta set into this kind of arrangement also add up to zero. Okay, now I'm going to describe the dynamics of these particles. In order to make it concrete, I will make it into a dance, a American country dance in which there is a caller. And the first thing the caller does, as in a real country dance, is call out promenade. And each one of these dancers moves one step in the direction of his or her arrow. This guy moves over to there, becomes this one. This guy moves over to there and becomes this one. This guy moves down and becomes this one, and so forth. That's one step of the square dance. The next step is also realistic for square dances. It's swing your partner. However, this is a somewhat mathematical square dance. So in fact, it's swing your partner if your total momentum is zero. So these two guys who have total momentum zero swing around and become these two. These three guys who have total momentum zero swing around and become these. This guy who has total momentum non-zero does nothing at all in this step, just remains fixed, and so forth. Well, and so forth means that we go through promenade, swing your partner, promenade, swing your partner. We go through that millions of times. And the dancers go through their steps millions of times. Since I don't own millions of dancers, I have to reach out for a computer which might do this for me. And here is the result of a computer simulation with a dance floor that goes 2 million lattice steps in this direction, 1 million in that direction, has a total of 2,000 lattice sites in this direction, 1,000 lattice sites in that direction, has a total of 1 million dancers on the dance floor. Each one of these arrows is an average of about 100 dancers in the neighborhood of that point. To make the thing interesting, make it work, there's a screen put here which reflects any dancer which comes into it. We make use of periodic boundary conditions in which a dancer who leaves here reappears up at the top, a dancer who leaves here reappears there, and to keep the motion going, every once in a while, a reappearing dancer is given an extra kick of momentum. That is kicked from that direction to that direction. Here is the pattern which is produced. You can recognize that pattern. It is the same as the pattern we saw of motion behind an obstacle of a two-dimensional fluid. It is indeed exactly the motion of a two-dimensional fluid. There is a theorem, almost a theorem, pretty close to a theorem, there is a quasi-theorem, a physicist's theorem, that says that this kind of thing will reproduce on an appropriately large scale, the Navier-Stokes equation. And what you're seeing here is the solution of the Navier-Stokes equation. Zanetti and McNamara, two students, and I didn't entirely believe the theorem, so we produced a computer simulation which did a simpler situation than this, just flow through a pipe, and we verified quantitatively that we got exactly the same thing out as the results of the solution of the Navier-Stokes equation. The earlier work of Demuyer, Signora, and Lallemand is depicted here, and it is also exactly the solution of the Navier-Stokes equation. So what do we learn? Very simple ingredients can produce very beautiful, rich, and patterned outputs. Thus, our square dancers, the simple promenades and swinger partners, make a complex flow pattern. The cellular automaton, which I described as a dance, produced a result which, you look at it on the gross scale, is exactly the Navier-Stokes equations. Consequently, the square dance contains the entire beautiful world of complex patterns produced by fluid motion. For this complexity, no intelligent creator is necessary. Simple events linked together and repeated sufficiently often can produce complex outcomes. I come in the direction of conclusions. Before I do that, since I seem to have a little bit of time, I'm going to tell you a little bit about Dembski's work, and then we'll go through the conclusions. Dembski, as I said, was a mathematician who was hired as a postdoc at Baylor University, where he was working on theorems that had to do with these complexity issues. He, like many, many people, visualized, so this is the accepted visualization, that biology, evolution, is a search for a lowest point in a complex landscape. That is, this is a landscape of fitness. Maybe it's the highest point you're looking for. Doesn't matter, but you're looking for an extremal in a landscape. And you look at it, you know about what you're doing and what other biological beasts similar to yourself are doing. And from this knowledge, wander in the landscape until you produce a maximum of fitness. This process was described by Darwin and described by many people after that. However, there is a theorem. The theorem is the no free lunch theorem, called that, of McCready and, bless me, I've forgotten the name of the other author. In any case, there's a theorem that says that if this landscape is sufficiently rough and sufficiently complex, no search process is quicker than a random walk. Random walk through this space, we're starting out someplace and going up to someplace else, would take much, much more time than the 5 billion years that the Earth has been around in order to produce a piece of DNA like the piece we own. This theorem, then, of McCready and company, according to Dembski, proves that there is the search for a proper fitness that might describe the complexity of you or me is futile in the few brief 5 billion years that we have been on Earth, that we living things have been on Earth. This is then a mathematical realization of the idea that was espoused beautifully by the Reverend Paling, espoused then by Behe, and is now set in mathematical form. Hence, if you believe in mathematics and one or two other things, you must accept that we are the result of an intelligent design. Or do you have to? We'll come back to that in a second. Our examples show that simple rules applied many times can make structures like the plume and machines like the heat engine. Thus, complexity can arise from simplicity. Complex patterns arise naturally and ubiquitously. What if superstructures like the machine we saw in the heated box were chaotic, and the super patterns arranged themselves into chaotic structures, and those structures were chaotic, and they rearranged themselves into chaotic structures, and so on through several levels of complexity. Such piling of complexity upon complexity could perhaps work to produce the richness of biological systems. We don't know much about how biological evolution really works. We have some knowledge, but we don't really have the fullest knowledge. We certainly don't know much about what happened to the earliest life forms or near the Big Bang. Dembski and Behe do us some good by pointing out to us this ignorance. But neither they nor the intelligent design people in general seem to have much positive to add to the discussion. A better view than theirs is that of St. Augustine of Hippo. His dates are 354 to 430. St. Augustine, in the translation of a modern Catholic scholar, Howard J. Van Til, the translation, I can't vouch for the translation. My Latin surely is not anywhere near up to it. But the translation says that Augustine says that the universe was brought into being in a less than fully formed state, but was gifted with the capacity to transform itself from unformed matter into a truly marvelous array of structure and life forms. I believe that. He published first. In the last 1600 years since St. Augustine, we've learned some specifics that fell to flesh out Augustine's good overview. We should not let the particular view of the universe provided by intelligent design's followers replace science in the school curricula. Instead, we should notice that evolutionary biology, paleontology, and cosmology are not speculations. They are root parts of science and human knowledge. They belong in schools as parts of the basics of our curriculum and of our understanding of the material world. Other subjects, unrooted in experiment, should be avoided in a school science classrooms. I thank you. You want me to tell you what was wrong with Dembski's argument? We are produced by machine, which is basically the laws of physics. The landscape, this landscape, is produced by the same machine. If the search process and the landscape are produced by the same machine, MacCready and
Wolpert.
MacCready and Wolpert's theorem does not apply, and we don't have to believe it. So in fact, this is a
situation. Why is that?
Excuse me?
Why is that, that if they're produced by the same machine?
Imagine that you have a coding machine and a decoding machine. Imagine that you have a coding machine and that you have access to that coding machine to see how it works. Then no theorem which tells you that, at least for classical things, no theorem that tells you how hard it is to break the code applies. You have access to the way the things make. This is a, now you may say I've reached a little bit in the argument. Well, I've reached because I believe that we are the product of a natural evolution. I believe I've reached because I believe in science and not intelligent design. Yes?
My memory is that the statement of the theorem is that no generic search algorithm does better than random walk on the average, on average generic landscapes.
Okay, there may be particular generic, there may be particular, no particular generic, particular landscapes on which you do better. And in particular, the landscape that is designed by the machine that you have just studied, and you probably have the key to it. So the, if I make a complaint about my own student, this occurs in paper, the actual description of what you're doing and where it comes from. The theorem occurs on a page 107 of his book, and there's a lot of stuff in the full page 107. But that's just a complaint.
So you pointed out why the theorem wouldn't apply, but can we say something in a positive sense that we could actually estimate the time that it would take for these evolutionary steps to take place? So that
we do not have the knowledge. That is, what we have to understand is how it is that nature produces complex things. I believe that there is a tendency for nature to produce complex things. I believe that once those complex things are produced, they in turn might be the source of complex things, which are in fact the putting together of the original set of complex things. In fact, I showed you one level of that in the machine to move heat upward. Nature produced the plumes and the other stuff, and that all worked together to move the heat upward. We have no knowledge about how those things work in multi-levels. If, in that sense, Dembski and Behe did us some good, they told us that we had to figure out what, how complexity could be piled on complexity to produce an even more complex outcome. But we have no estimate. We have no estimate of the time it would, a simpler thing, the time it takes the proteins in your body to fold into the form they make. The present theory of that is that you have selected proteins by the process of evolution that fold themselves quickly and surely. And so we have, science has avoided the protein folding question. There may be a way of avoiding the landscape search question that I asked. We do not know. We have no knowledge.
So related to that, I was wondering, did the intelligent design people focus their attack just on production of the early life forms, or do they even, it sounds like they even attack evolution. How can you attack that, which is just an established fact?
They're political people. They are willing to accept everyone who follows their thoughts into their camp. They have flat earth people, and the people believe that the earth was created 6,000 years ago, and Republicans and all kinds of believers in their camp. That's just politics. But they do make scientific arguments, and we do have to, I believe, we're responsible for dealing with scientific arguments. There's a question back there.
Yeah, I thought the point is that there isn't a fixed landscape. I mean, clearly, when there are many species evolving simultaneously, the fitness is coded. I mean, it's a non-linear process, right? So, for example, the peacock's tail is clearly not because there's a niche in a fixed landscape for it. It depends on co-evolution within the species. So, I mean, this theorem clearly just doesn't apply anyway.
I believe that that you could say, you could, by defining the landscape appropriately, by including, for example, peahens in the land, by including peahens in the evolutionary process rather than as part of the landscape, you could then get this as an evolution in a fixed landscape. You have a right to choose what the landscape is and is not. And you can either choose to put the peahens in or put them out. And I remember people telling me something about this, which is roughly speaking, am I making the right choice? You can do it in a fixed landscape. I believe there was a question over there. Lee?
Yeah, so then I think we should distinguish a in principle question from a methodological question, because I think that point is correct. But I don't think you want to claim that any number of biologists getting together can anticipate all the possible niches and all the possible things that natural selection might take advantage of, all the possible coincidences that might be taken advantage of, and somehow write a computer code to, you know, write down at one time what the landscape for all possible collections of species is. So this is not against natural selection, but it's against theoretical biology, which is that one is extremizing on a pre-existing, fixed, understood landscape.
There is no doubt that we scientists do not have full understanding of this. The people who, that's another way of saying it is the biologists don't fully understand it. We don't understand it either, physicists, but biologists don't understand it. And on the other hand, it's not our, we cannot understand everything. It's good that we got told that we don't understand it, and we should respond by trying to understand as much as we can. And some of this discussion is indeed that response. How much of it can we understand? Where are the holes in our argument? And I thank you for doing that. That's the right thing to do. Point out where the strong points are in our argument, where the weak points are. However, I do point out that for most people in the room, not for everybody, but for most people in the room, the outcome of the argument is predetermined by our religion.
Question over here.
I know nothing about intelligent design, but an obvious question, if one believes it's intelligence, that the biological systems are too complicated to have just happened, and they're being driven by some kind of intelligence. An obvious question is that intelligence more or less complicated than the system itself? Because if intelligence is more complicated than the system, then this explains absolutely nothing.
Yes.
So is God an amoeba? Is that it?
I don't believe in the existence of God in any particular form that I could recognize. So the answer is God an amoeba? Well, could be, yeah, the big one, but the rich one, the complicated one, but I don't know.
So what would the position of an intelligence design person be? Would they imagine this intelligence to be more or less complicated than the system itself?
They would at this point do what I'm doing, which is obfuscate. The basic argument is right, they say, I say, and then these are details which we can't deal with at this moment. Why don't we talk about it after the lecture? And that's, I believe, what they would say, although they're pretty clever people and have thought about some of these things. I think this question has been raised before. In fact, I'm pretty sure it's been raised before. And I don't think an appropriate answer has been given. I want you to say, lots of intelligent people have thought about questions like this and have come up with not much, so much more than I.
Just maybe a comment addressing the previous question. If you posit that a less intelligent entity can create a more intelligent entity, then there seems to be a fairly natural path of starting with arbitrarily low intelligence and by natural processes working up. So that seems to be an almost content-free conclusion. It seems that if intelligent design folks were to make a content-carrying argument, it would have to be that what we see around us was created by something more intelligent.
Pardon? You mean it's war for George Bush?
Let's accept it was created by a more intelligent object, but there is another possibility which should be discussed, and that is that let us imagine that we had the natural processes. Can you imagine, and that's part of the and the Behe argument, can you imagine the 30 working parts of a flagellum for E. coli coming together in any natural way to produce a working flagellum? And you can't, basically. But that doesn't mean that it didn't happen, it just means that you can't imagine. Yes?
Yeah, I'd like to take on your the statement you just made as an aside, which you made at the beginning, that our belief in the usefulness of laws of nature is a religion, in some sense, on the same basis as other folk religions. The statements you made are metaphysical statements, and they can be discussed as metaphysical statements, but would you disagree with the following, that there's a much weaker set of statements that are quite sufficient to underlie what we do as physicists, which are something along the lines of, it has been useful so far in the study of natural phenomena to posit certain kinds of laws of physics, which we study in isolate, you know, when we study isolated systems in a laboratory, it's become useful to develop a mode of explanation where we separate laws from initial conditions, and we learn that we can apply one set of laws to many different laboratory situations by varying the initial conditions. And we have found this to be very useful for the past several hundred years. It does not mean that this is the only methodology for its knowledge about the natural world. It doesn't mean that it will not have to be modified. But it so far has proved very successful, and therefore we pragmatically, at least when we're dealing with similar contexts as isolated systems in the big universe, we continue to use it.
Let me argue with that point of view.
Okay.
People who are predisposed to believe in science believe in science. People who are not predisposed to believe in science don't. People who are predisposed to believe that it's useful believe that it's useful. People who aren't necessarily. There are things for which it is absolutely useless. If I want to understand how my spouse is going to behave tomorrow, I should not use any scientific arguments. that is intended to be a gender independent statement. But that human behavior is, and other very important things are at the moment beyond the reach of science. Science is only successful because we define it to be successful. Partially successful because we define it to ourselves.
I disagree. I actually think that there is, the successes of science are persuasive and have been persuasive to people. One has to start out having good faith in the argument, but I think that it has been persuasive. But a weaker notion of science than the one that you present, that is, I don't think it's necessary to believe something like there is a final law of nature that exists timelessly, and solutions to which, one solution of which is isomorphic to the whole history of nature in all respects.
I didn't quite say that. I surely did not make the distinction between initial conditions.
Right, but I'm suggesting that one can make a stronger case for a weaker, more precise notion than it just happens to work because we are the people who like it to work.
But we have an emotional attachment to science, which is more connected with what I said than what you said, in my opinion.
Can I?
Please, I'm sorry.
You agree, though, that there's some element of science that I'm just guessing that the intelligent design people would embrace, that if you want to build a bridge or a building or a computer, then it's probably useful, you know, to accept the pragmatism.
But if you wanted to decide about whether stem cells should be... Or if you wanted to ask whether children should be taught that there is no purpose to the universe. Well, I believe there's no purpose to the universe. On the other hand, intelligent design people and 60% of the people in the US would object strongly to having their children taught that the universe is free of purpose.
But that should not be part of the curriculum, though.
I agree with you.
Not science. Roman, you had another question?
Well, I'm confused
by two separate points about what you just said, and I hope you'll forgive me for pushing at them.
Please do.
The first is, you seem to be arguing that, and I agree with you on this, that science does not have much meaningful to say about value decisions. And I'm happy to grant that the question of should we do this or should we do that is dependent on what we value, and science really doesn't have a lot to say about that. But you seem to be extending from that to the conclusion that there are many people who would not see any purpose to science at all because science cannot answer certain value questions. And that I'm not convinced by. Just briefly, the second thing is, you said science is useless for letting you predict what your spouse will do tomorrow. And I'm wondering, are you narrowing specifically by science here, do you mean extremely concise laws of the type that that fit on the back of a t-shirt? Because certainly I can use, statistical experiments to do a much better job than random chance at predicting people. And I would consider that to be science, and I'm curious whether you're not counting that as science.
Would you extend that to economics?
Sure. I mean, economics seems like science.
It is probably an example of a pseudoscience.
So you answered my second question.
I think we ought to recognize that schools are a place where we all come together, and that we have to worry in schools about the sensitivity of people who do not share our values and point of view about the world. That the particular thing that they most want to see outside of the curriculum is that a humanistic expression of values, if they would agree with it. I think that's what the Discovery Institute is all about. Just as we would like to see out of the curriculum an anti-scientific expression of values. And not unreasonable to try to reach a compromise, which might include both. Please.
Here you're preaching to the choir, as they say, but obviously this was not designed for the choir. So I'm just curious what kind of response you get when you present this to, a neutral audience or a hostile.
Choirs and Lutheran.
Yeah, that choir. Well, how do they respond?
They also, it is impossible or difficult to get an audience together to listen to a talk about a subject which includes hybrid analysis without having people who belong to the choir. So I have never really had a hostile audience. The most hostile person in the audience that I've had is Kieran, whose name you know, in Vienna. But he wasn't very hostile either. Can I produce hostility? Maybe I can produce hostility. Just as I don't believe that the intelligent design should be in the school curriculum, I don't believe the string theory should be in the school curriculum. I'm not at all sure the Big Bang should be in the school curriculum. And I'm not at all sure that the origins of life belong in the school curriculum. Pretty soon, so I'll get a hostile response.
I just want to make a little distinction. It seems like to me like the issue is a little bit narrower. It's the issue is about whether to allow intelligent design into the science portion of the school's curriculum, not directly connected with the general question of whether you should teach values of some sort of school. Although it's interesting, I think, in the U.S., that people are averse to teaching values, to preaching particular moral points of view, and that this is actually a way of sneaking them in. But said something wrong. sneaking them in, to sneak them in via a science course. That's maybe the agenda of the discovery. So, I mean, would you make a narrower argument that the intelligent design is not scientific, that, that Dembski is not acting scientifically? I mean, I think that seems to be the sort of the wedge.
I would try to make the argument that Dembski is behaving scientifically, that he constructed a scientific argument, and that it is proven on careful examination to be wrong.
Okay, and exclude that along with many other more dubious scientific claims, such as
that is,
string theory.
Trying to draw the people who are want to think about such things into an argument on our terrain, using our techniques, discuss our issues. And to some extent, I think that can be done by not getting emotional about it, by admitting some of the weaknesses in our argument. And damn it, you might learn something about our subjects by thinking about what they say. Because they're not fools, people. Dembski's not a fool either. They're not fools, they're intelligent people, and they're worth thinking about.
Mm-hmm.
At least that's my point of view, and it's, I think, good politics for the American Physical Society.
Yes. Would one, you know, like to, instead of distinguishing between, like, the actual statements as being, like, this body of knowledge and science and this body of knowledge that are ideas for intelligent design, would one distinguish between attitudes to what those ideas? Because I think you can be, like, dogmatic about scientific ideas as well about like theistic ideas, that is not grounded, taken from authority.
I find Steve Weinberg very dogmatic about many issues. However, I don't think I should discount his papers because he is dogmatic about religious issues.
But it's not disqualifying the ideas, but it's, so to say, for example, the question we're supposed to teach that in school. I think one part of the like critical thinking is to be careful with the claims of certain ideas, the claims of statements. How far are we supposed to push them? We have a theory that is, you know, applying fluids. How far can we extend that? Is that true, universally true everywhere, or is it just true, you know, true scientific sense in a certain area of the
We, in science, many of us, maybe not all of us, but many of us push these things as far as we can. That's part of what we learn to do. I push studies of fluids into a point of view about the universe. And I don't apologize for it, but I don't tell you that it's something every school child should believe.
So we, let's thank Professor Kedemoff.